Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 comics sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. The numbers we're going to be talking about in this episode are the top 300 comic sales for September 2018 is sold through Diamond to retailers in North America. This is what sells into the stores, not what they've sold to us. And it covers all the main new comics and such. We've actually got the top 500, but I usually limit the comparisons month-to-month to the top 300, because that's what we've got going back 15 years or so now. Looking at the breakdown of that top 300, as should come as no surprise, because it's usually the case, Marvel had the largest part of that with 48.87% of the units, DC with 33.03%, and Image a ways distant, actually, as it kind of usually is, with 7.56%. Pretty much nothing unusual there. I suppose I really jumped the gun, and I should have mentioned we've got both Sam and Eric on the call this time. I should have started with that, shouldn't I?
That's okay. We're still here.
That's true.
My apologies. It's gotten to where I've done this so many times, it's just, you know, a little bit of muscle memory and just a habit at that point. At this point, I really... literally almost 9 times out of 10, Marvel's in front, DC's not that far behind, or sometimes, you know, 15 points, but it's the other top dog by a wide margin. Then you've got Image, the other kind of premier publishers, Dark Horse, IDW, Boom, and Dynamite. They're in the single-digit percentage. Dark Horse had 2.68% of the units, IDW 2.58%, Boom 1.1%, and Dynamite 1.09%. You add those all up, and you're still not even talking the Image numbers. Actually, you're not that far off, though, because those other four premier publishers total up to, 7.45% versus the 7.56% for Image. But then, really, everyone's a distant ways behind the big two. And I think a lot of this kind of goes back to how long some of these publishers have been around. And, you know, longevity building up over time, it benefits some of the publishers.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't disagree. I think that the big two have, you know, for the longest amount of time had the heavy momentum. They've got the biggest universes. They've got the most widely known characters. And we see that play out, you know, month after month.
Well, and I think to a degree, they've also got the deepest Rolodex.
That's for sure.
I mean, they've worked with not necessarily literally everybody, but pretty close, and they've got all the big characters that everybody grew up on thinking, wow, I want to write Batman or the Avengers or the X-Men or Superman or whomever.
Yeah, and Image, between Walking Dead not being at its height anymore and all the breaks and random things, I mean, there was a point where Image was consistently around 10%, and that's not quite happening anymore either.
Well, and I think at that point, they tended to have more than just The Walking Dead. They had Saga, which is on a year hiatus right now. They had, Jupiter's Legacy. East of West was bigger at that point.
Oh, yeah.
And a few other things like that.
Yeah, like I said, not just Walking Dead, but all the hiatuses, too. There seems to be more and more of those that are being announced over there.
Well, and I've said this before, and I'll say it again. Image's biggest strength is sometimes its biggest weakness, and that's the fact it's predominantly an umbrella publisher, and they've got the shiny new thing every month, which is great. It gives people who want that something, you know, 5 or 6 things to check out. But titles rotate in and out. So if you've got something that's doing gangbusters, you may not necessarily have that 8, 9 months down the line from then. So, shall we jump over to the actual list itself?
Yeah, let's do it.
Top three items have something in common. They're all event titles, arguably, and you could probably argue both sides of that. Top one, Return of Wolverine number 1, part of its 5-part limited series. 260,411 units, so obviously it did well. Don't know if it's going to stay up that well or not, but it's still going to sell well for the other four issues. Followed by Heroes in Crisis number 1, 140,703 units, and then Doomsday Clock number 7, 130,976 units. There has been talk in the past of event fatigue. This isn't even all the events from Marvel and DC. We got Infinity Wars down at what, rank 18 with 63,703 units. Do we have too many events going on? Too many things trying to be that high profile story?
Well, you've also got Spider-Geddon going on. That's true. At number 12. And I can't recall if it was September or if it started in October, but you had the Justice League Wonder Woman crossover, and then now you've got the Justice League Aquaman crossover.
Do you consider those event books or just crossovers?
I think because there's, you know, anywhere from 4 to 7 or 9 books in the series, to me that would constitute more of an event. You know, when it's essentially crossing over into two titles plus a start and an end, that there's definitely something more than just a single issue crossover. I would consider maybe even like a, say, Flash goes to Batman, Batman goes to Flash. That would be a crossover type event. But when you've got, you know, anchor books on the front and the back end, I consider that to be more of an event. Or when it crosses over into three titles, plays out over the course of a month to 2 months, those are the types of things that I would consider an event.
Interesting. I personally, and this is just my own kind of rule of thumb, if it's one of those things that seems to touch the majority of the titles in the line, I consider that an event. So kind of that line-wide is implied in my mind. But I see what you're saying about the difference between a character guest starring in another book and then the reciprocal guest star or whatever being different than you've got the bookends around it and maybe a third title or something.
Right.
To me, the Wonder Woman Justice League, the Aquaman Justice League, those two things are something a little bit more than just a crossover or a guest star sort of situation, but not up at that kind of line-wide event level. And then even between those two, I would say something like Extermination, which is starting to touch all the X titles, that's kind of limited to an editorial office, if you will, is, again, somewhere in between. There's a stratification there, and not all of them are equal, but it's increasingly difficult to really categorize, well, is Spider-Geddon kind of the equivalent of that office, editorial office thing like Extermination, or is it got enough books in it? Because, geez, that's got, with the miniseries, I don't know how many, like at least a dozen, it feels like.
Yeah.
That starts to feel a little bit more like a line-wide event, other than the fact it's really only touching the Spider characters.
Yeah, and then you've got Heroes in Crisis and Doomsday Clock over on the DC side, where you're including all of your main characters, obviously, in Heroes in Crisis, so there's, you know, line-wide implications potentially there. Doomsday Clock, we know they're crossing that entire Watchmen universe over into DC, so it's kind of, yeah, I think there's a lot of murkiness, but I think ultimately what the sales tell us is that I don't think that the events, however you call it, whether it's line-wide, isolated, whatever, doesn't seem to necessarily negatively impact things. If anything, it does show a little bit of a boost because we've got new titles that didn't exist before. But I don't know, Sam might have a counterpoint to say that the overall sales are going down, so maybe they don't. It's kind of a coin flip, I guess, how you want to argue it.
I mean, they work. We're seeing more and more of them because they work better. I do think it negatively impacts, more so than normal, the kind of standard drop and the ability of titles to just maintain any kind of momentum. But I'm not sure eliminating them at this point would bring any of that back.
Well, and I think that's a great point, because as much as events may get overused, certainly as much as variant covers get overused, or number ones, or whatever kind of hot-button item somebody may have, and obviously I've got a number of them I just listed, if you got rid of them, I think there's a strong argument for the publishers would just be leaving money on the table. So there's no real business case for them to stop doing what they're doing. I mean, you can look at Infinity Wars, which is selling in the mid-60s. I'm not going to say that's a winning event for Marvel, because typically that would be, you know, over the 100,000 mark by a pretty wide degree, and it's not. But it's, I mean, to Eric's point, it's you know, 63,000 plus units they wouldn't have had otherwise just for that one issue, and that's not counting all of the other Infinity War kind of one-shots or miniseries or, you know, whatever going on.
Well, and I don't think it's a... The issue is, what could replace it? Would better storytelling on, you know, Iron Man, Cap, whatever, replace that Infinity Wars spot? And I think the long-term answer is probably yes. But years and years of this, it would take years to recover the consumer confidence to do that again.
Well, spinning that a slightly different way, if more of the books were in the 50, 60, 70,000 sales range, and not just a handful of titles or whatever, would they need to go to the event well as often? And when they did, it would, I presume, work a lot better.
No, I agree. But yeah. I don't know how long it would take to get back. I don't know. The average books are just so, I don't even want to say average at this point, relegated to unimportant. Between the writing for the trade, the constant reboots, the fact that if anything of any kind of consequence is going to happen, they're going to tell you about it and make a miniseries out of it. It becomes a point where, why just get the regular issue? So you just wait for them to tell you, here's the miniseries where something might actually happen. Buy that. And it would take years and all the publishers working together to undo that.
If it's even undoable, which I kind of question, and I think there's actually a really interesting counterpoint to what you're talking about there at rank 6, where they had a character guest star in Batman 54. A pivotal thing happened to that character, and next month we'll see how that impacts that character's title. That, of course, is Nightwing. So it kind of is the perfect counterexample, because it kind of proves the point of, well, if they do something and they don't do a miniseries about it and they just kind of tell the story, does it matter? And I would argue that it didn't move the needle at all on the sales of Batman. And we don't have Nightwing 50 here. It'll be in next month's numbers to know how it moved the needle on that title. But it's one of the few examples I can think of where they're actually doing what to a particular character is a life-changing event in the course of, well, in this case, a guest star in another title.
Well, and see, that's the key there. Nightwing, let me find it, is on...
It's down at ranks 87 and 88 with 48 and 49, and it's doing around the mid-25,000s.
And exactly. So, I mean, that's kind of the point. Even when they didn't choose to over-publicize it, miniseries, et cetera, they went, well, no one's really going to read this there. So let's do it someplace else where people are reading it, and they put it in the book that sells around 100,000-ish anyways.
Yeah, roughly four times what the Nightwing title is selling.
Yes.
And, I mean, he used to be Robin, Batman and Robin. It's not like it's a odd place for it to happen. It just, again, he's got his own book. You would think that magnitude of a story arc or plot point or whatever would happen in his book.
Especially since it doesn't seem to affect the rest of the Bat family as much as you might think it would.
Yeah.
At least it hasn't in the storytelling so far.
It just seems like when they're trying to do so many, hey, look at me kind of high profile stories at once, either just within either Marvel or DC, much less across both, it's harder and harder for any of those to really gain kind of the traction they need, I think. I mean, I could probably go down each one of them and point out what I consider are kind of the almost Achilles heels of each one of these things. You know, Doomsday Clock, the schedule is its main Achilles heel, I think. I'll be honest, I didn't think Heroes in Crisis got off to a really great start for me, story-wise. And then that's not even tossing in one or two of the other things that were a big, hey, look at me, you should buy this, with like Batman Damned at rank number 5 with 95,481 units.
When we get to that one, I actually have a weird question about
it. You want to ask now? That's fine.
So, I was at my comic shop, and to be fair, I know the owner pretty well and all that. It was very weird that I was buying my books and my son was looking around. And picked up, I don't know, some Batman thing. And as I was checking out, the owner, who knows me, went, you pick up Batman Damned? I'm not that interested. And he handed me a copy and said, well, your son likes Batman. Have him check this out.
Oh my gosh.
And again, my son is seven.
Okay.
And I don't know if, and to be fair, I know the owner pretty well. I'm sure it wasn't intentional, and he's a Marvel guy, and he's just trying to do a night. It just,
yeah,
it's just one of those weird things where it's like, boy, you know, and it was one of those weird things where I got home and Eddie's, you know, and Eddie said something about going to the comic, and my wife said anything interesting happened. And I kind of said, no, nothing. And then after, like, he was gone, I kind of turned to her and said, you know, hey, you know, so-and-so gave this to me, and but flipped through it because I don't think this is going to be appropriate. And I was right, of course.
Yes, yes, you were. Even the one panel aside, I don't think that's this kind of a story for a seven-year-old just to begin with.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, to me, that's kind of what I refer to as the Underoos rule. Any character that they're going to plaster on kids' pajamas or whatever, and clearly market towards young kids, there's a certain responsibility of how you tell stories and what you publish with that kind of a character. And I'm not saying you can't tell adult stories with Batman, but clearly here's a case where they kind of did, and even with the Black Label and everything DC did, not everybody really clued in.
And that's the point. I mean, I'm not nearly as clued into this stuff as I used to be, but I'm still doing the podcast. I still read comics. I'm in the shop fairly regularly. Mm-hmm. I was kind of aware of it enough to go, wait a minute, I should look at this. And again, I think I go to a great shop with a very good owner. He wasn't quite clued in. And we talked about this when they announced all this stuff. And aside from all the marketing points that were brought up about why it's a bad idea to say, oh, this Batman's for this age group and this one's for this age. It's just, it's a bad idea. I don't understand this thinking that somehow any of this, you know. And to be fair, if you go extremely kiddie or all ages or whatever you want to call it, or teen, or don't get the stratification.
Yeah, I agree with the over pollution of different age group lines. I think that trying to focus the writing and the art on a more general audience is definitely the better play. Obviously, it reduces your title load, which reduces your cost load as a publisher and increases your availability. However, the counterpoint that I would make with the Batman Damned, or I guess the Black Label in totality, is I think Marvel proved a while ago that you can run a mature line in tandem with your standard line, with obviously with Marvel Max, and it affords creators a little bit more leeway to tell stories that maybe couldn't otherwise be put into all age titles. Now, I didn't find anything in Batman Damned to be offensive to adults. I didn't find anything that was too much. I think that had DC taken more of a blatant approach of saying this line is a mature line, period. But they instead focused on the boutique nature of it and the different trade dress sizing and those types of things, and they kind of danced around the fact. And now they're kind of doubling back on what they had said, and we're hearing some frustrations from both retailers and creators saying, you know, you said that this was going to be a creator-driven line where we could tell the stories we wanted to with the characters that we grew up loving, and now you're basically handcuffing us. So there's a real question out there of, is this line actually going to work? Are these stories that have even started actually going to see light and finish? Creators are basically saying, you're giving me control and now taking it away. How is that going to impact things? So I think, all in all, I think it was more of a rollout issue than it was the issue of creating this specific line. Because I know there were a number of people who were very much looking forward to kind of that Marvel Max type feel within DC. And add to that the point of DC's current film franchise has been a much darker, much edgier, much grittier feel than, say, what Marvel's interpretation of the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the Marvel characters have been. You're trying to create a vision of, you know, much grittier, darker, doom and gloom characters on the screen. You don't really have that portrayed as such. I mean, there are components of it. I will admit to that. There are components in the current books, but nothing to the level of how it plays out on the screen. So you've just got so many different visions of things. And it's DC is, to me, kind of a unfortunately, because DC is my favorite character set, they're a little bit of a mess right now. They don't know what they want to be. They want to pander to everyone and please no one all at the same time.
Well, and I think they're going back to the grim and gritty approach. And I think your point about Marvel having proven that you could do it successfully with the Marvel Max line is a very good point.
But I think to the Marvel Max line, though, that was what, Deadpool, Punisher? I'm trying to remember. When the Marvel Max line started, who were the first couple of characters?
Well, yeah, you had Punisher, you had Daredevil, you had Jessica Jones came out of that. Trying to think who else was involved. Basically the Netflix, your Netflix characters, essentially.
The point is, you didn't start with Spider-Man and Captain America, which is kind of what you're doing. You start with Batman or Superman. So true. I think that is different.
I would agree with that, but Batman has had a long storied history of more darker tendencies due to his mental state, due to his characters, things like Scarecrow, and there's a darker surrounding him than maybe there are some of those other main Marvel characters. Now, the Superman take is supposed to be something completely different. It's not supposed to be as dark and as gloom and doom, or I guess a deeper, heavier tones as Batman Damned is. So it's one of those things where, again, they were trying to create, like, from what I understood, they're trying to create an environment of freedom for creators to do something with these characters in the tone of the character. I don't think anyone who read Batman Damned would say anything that was in there was drastically out of character for Bruce. I just don't think you would hear that. Much like Punisher Max, you would say there was nothing in there that was really out of character for Frank Castle.
Well, I think that's fair.
The other point I wanted to bring up, just because you bring up, like, the DC, take the Suicide Squad out of the film universe. There's no R-rated films in there. I think you can do gloomy, darker world, which some would argue the DC universe kind of has always been more than the Marvel universe, without necessarily going for that explicitly not kids. I mean, the Batman the Animated Series was a pretty dark and gritty, gloomy thing, but that didn't mean it wasn't appropriate for children. I think there's a weird place where mature and gritty or gloomy are synonymous, and they aren't synonymous words. One's about mood, one's about appropriate. And they're not synonymous.
Well, and I agree with that, but I would also then put the Netflix Marvel series to you and say, no, that's not stuff you're going to show a kid.
That I agree with. That is more mature. I agree.
So it's one of those things where I think it's a creative interpretation, and again, the whole point of this line was to allow creators to express themselves differently or tell different stories. Max was a reason to, again, tell a little bit more explicit story. So I don't see that there's really a difference between the two lines. I could understand the stance of Batman versus maybe a Daredevil or a Punisher, but I still think it's the same basic premise. I think that the marketing was just completely botched by DC, and unfortunately has devolved into something unfortunate for the creators, ultimately.
Well, let me ask a couple of questions around the whole marketing aspect. I had a coworker on my last job who was a casual comic fan, and at one point I had a conversation with him, and he was really confused by, and this was over 10 years ago, the Ultimate X-Men title, because it was so different than, like, Uncanny and the other X-Men books at the time. Now, at the time, I thought that the Ultimate line had a very particular trade dress that unified those titles. I knew it was its own narrative universe set apart from the Marvel mainstream one and such, but here was a casual comic fan that was completely lost on him. Are they able to successfully brand comics as either being in a separate narrative universe or being a this is the mature line, this is the kids line, or whatever, without being, you know, obvious in terms of this is cartoony art, this is not, kind of thing? Are they able to really establish brands the way they used to, I think? Or were they ever able to?
I think that the way that they attempted to do that was to put the Black Label moniker on it as kind of the signal to say, hey, similar to how Marvel had the big capital letters Max on the top of the covers. It was kind of meant to be that visual awareness that there was a distinction between them. Now, if they had done a completely different trade dress, obviously that's going to be a much more visual way of seeing it. But again, the way that DC positioned this line was it is creator's choice. So you've got the Batman Damned, which is a treasury size, I think, or magazine size. And then you've got the Superman book, I think, was going to be more of a taller format. So there's going to be all these different size formats, which is going to throw off your trade dress. I mean, so I think that there's ways they could have done it, but the way they position the line, I don't know if they gave themselves the ability to do that easily.
I think if you were to ask a lot of longtime Marvel fans to define the Epic line back when it was essentially creator-owned works, I'm not sure if everyone would have identified it as such. So I question, while they may do a decent job trying to get the message out, how well that message can get heard.
Understood. And I think the way that people want to see things is akin to Sports Illustrated when they had Sports Illustrated and Sports Illustrated for Kids. There was a very different look because it had the big word kids across Illustrated. So like it was very visual and obvious to see. And I guess it's a challenge for the publishers to have to figure out how can you do that and distinguish the difference so that you know. But again, I don't want to say anything about your comic retailer, Sam, because he sounds like he's a great guy, and obviously you've trusted him for a number of years. I just find it very interesting that he would put Batman Damned in the hands of, potentially in the hands of a 7-year-old. It just from looking at the cover, I would assume that you would want to investigate and confirm, but it could have just been one of those things where he was thinking of you too, and that's the assumption I'm going to make, kind of dad and son time thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's best to assume good intent. I don't think anyone would be running a shop without that, but it is an unfortunate sort of mistake.
Yeah, and again, you know, I'm conscientious enough to take care of it, et cetera, et cetera. And again, I harbor no ill will or anything towards.
Oh yeah.
Again, my shop owner's a great guy, but it's just Eric brought up an interesting point that I hear. I don't exactly disagree with it, but I kind of do about creator freedom. You know, there's creative freedom. There's absolutely always kind of creative, but to some degree, there becomes a question of you chose the wrong profession. You know, I love crime noir. I love it. I just do. I know John, you like the hard case crime comics, which I haven't read, but I read almost all the original novels in that original series, as and still do as they come out. If I became an author of crime noir, I would not go, you know what I want to publish is a children's book. And there's this idea that if you want these really mature themes and stuff, I kind of got to question your thinking when you go, you know what I want to go into? Superhero comics at Marvel and DC. Why?
Or to phrase it another way, I want to use those characters I loved watching on Saturday morning cartoons.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think there's a certain aspect of if you want to tell those kinds of stories, and I think there's definitely an audience and a place for them, and I've read such stories, you know, and enjoyed them, but doing it with pre-existing characters that have a certain amount of historical baggage around them and have been targeted to particular audiences, be it all ages or kids or whatever, and saying, like you said, those are the characters I want to use for this. You almost want to pull a Watchmen and say, you know what, I could use the various existing characters, or I could do a serious repaint on them and create new ones and tell this story with them.
Yeah, I guess I to kind of go along, Sam, with what you're saying, I think of it somewhat akin to, let's just use a really bad example of Romeo and Juliet. The story of Romeo and Juliet has been around for a few years, and there have been countless interpretations along the way, some adapted for kids. Some very, very mature graphic-based ones that are, you know, accentuating different components of the love story, different components of the death, different, you know, however you want to take it. And I don't see that as anything different than what we're talking about right now in comics. I think that by and large, a creative endeavor is a creative endeavor. The only difference is that you have DC Comics who owns the creative content, so to speak, of the characters, and therefore has the ability to reject and accept any proposal. So I think that when, so for me, we talked a little bit about it. I don't know if we talked about it on the recording, but we definitely talked about it after the recording last month, was I absolutely love Dick Grayson and Barbara Gordon together.
Mm-hmm.
And I want, if I was to write anything, I would want to write an entire story of their life together. The only way that I could ever see that story happening is either A, an Elseworlds, or B, something in this just complete, creator type boutique sort of offering that is completely standalone, isn't on a different earth. It just is what it is. And I guess that's the part for me, like that would get me interested in reading that. That's a story that I would want to hear. Maybe I'd want to tell someday, but the way that DC is treating the properties right now, that really wouldn't be what they would want. They want the intrigue to be there because that keeps people excited, so to speak. And so I think you can have it both ways. And I think that to give this, I think for DC to have given this opportunity to the creators and to kind of take it back, I think that's where the problem lies. Whether or not they should have given it to the creators, that's a different question than what happened.
But I guess the question is, what creative freedom should they be giving out? Should they be giving out, hey, you can tell some stories without the confines of the current continuity? I'd be okay with that. Do Elseworlds type stuff. But to do it with different levels of maturity and appropriateness and stuff like that, that's where I think it starts to get dicier.
So let's change this question just a little bit and analyze it from a different area. So we know that DC has their main line. We know that DC has Black Label. And we know that DC is coming out with essentially two new sets of books, DC Inc. and DC Zoom. Would we be having this discussion, and would it be as big of a deal if they just had DC Main Universe and DC Mature?
It depends how blatantly obvious it was which line a book was in. To me, going back to the Sports Illustrated for Kids, the big four kids clues you in, and even if you have no idea about the branding otherwise, you can read it and figure it out. So if they had literally a DC Mature Readers label, that might work. I think there's still a little risk there. But is it coming down to that they don't want to tell, the creators don't want to tell all ages stories, or they don't want to be constrained by the current continuity?
And again, those are different things. I mean, you bring up Dick and Barbara's relationship. That has been explored here and there. And again, I could totally see an Elseworlds or, again, something like what's going on with Nightwing now, where you could forget it at the end of it or whatever. That is entirely different than the theming, at least where this conversation started with this Black Label stuff.
Sure.
And here's a perfect example. DC kind of went down this road with Animal Man and Swamp Man and Constantine, or Swamp Thing and Constantine, when they were part of the Vertigo universe. And kind of like with the Max stuff, there was a way to separate them into a more mature area. But again, you didn't go with Superman and Batman.
Yeah, but even then, the lines were a little blurry because you'd still have, like, Animal Man showing up in the Justice League at times. So it was kind of its own universe, but kind of not. But expectations of what a Vertigo title was were much clearer.
But again, showing up in the Justice League is one thing, being Batman's entire, yes, Marvel could do the, Daredevil's been in the Justice League. If Marvel decides to do another Max line and they pick Black Knight, nobody kind of is going to care. But again, you do it with Spider-Man or Cap, it's a different thing.
That's fair.
I would argue that it would not be out of the realm of possibility to see either of those two in a Max line. Just based on the multitude of Spider titles that have been going on, there's the new video game Spider that's coming in with all the Spider-Geddon stuff. I mean, there are different Spider-Man takes out there now where it would not be out of the realm. Now, Peter Parker, traditional Spider-Man, absolutely not.
Yeah, exactly.
But now that you've got 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 different Spider-Men running around, it would not be out of the realm of possibility to see that.
Absolutely.
Cap, after what Nick Spencer did with Cap?
I don't disagree, but again, if this was Batman Beyond, we wouldn't be having this discussion.
I would agree with that.
And that's kind of where you were going with the Spider. If it was Venom, I wouldn't say the same thing.
Yeah, understood.
On the whole Spider-Man topic, though, are we hitting a point where there's a Spider-Man fatigue? Because to your point, Eric, there's a ton of Spider-Men. or spider people going around. particularly during Spider-Geddon. And it's a little insane. I mean, I'm behind on my reading, so I haven't read most of that, any of that stuff yet, really. But do we need a non-Peter Parker Spider-Man in the Spider-Man title itself? Not long ago, we had the Spider-Man 2020 or 2099 title. That's gone away in favor of a Ben Reilly title. We now have Spider-Force, Spider-Girls, Vault of Spiders, Spider-Geddon itself. We just recently had Edge of Spider-Geddon.
And Friendly Neighborhood is coming.
Yeah. Well, again, that's a Peter Parker one, right?
It is, but it's yet another, throw another title of Spider in it.
Well, and with Peter Parker, Spectacular Spider-Man back, we've gone from having one Amazing Spider-Man three times a month back to the three different titles, and it comes down to a little bit of the branding issue and whatnot. Are there supposed to be relevant differences across these titles or not?
Oh, and don't forget Renew Your Vows.
Which is a different continuity and timeline.
Yep.
And just to make matters more confusing, that Spider-Ling, I think it is one of the Spider-Girls in Spider-Girls, I believe.
Right. With Mayday and...
And one of the Prime Universe Spider-Girls. Yep. I forget which one because they've had like five. And this is where trying to explain anything about almost any comic to somebody who's a casual fan is almost a losing battle. It's just so convoluted and so complex and kind of doesn't need to be.
Yeah. So I guess ultimately, I don't know. I think we agree and on some concepts of having some of that creative freedom. And then we also agree that there's a right time and place. It's interesting to say the least. It's interesting. And I know that just the reception from readers coming into the shop. So we saw Batman Damned one. Once the panel was exposed, pardon the pun, it just shot up like crazy on eBay on the secondary market. And there's a speculator component out there to it, but we had more people wanting to come in and check out the story, maybe a little interested in seeing that, but more interested in the story and frustrated that they couldn't get the book than we had for other issues. And I can't remember what the price was on Batman Damned, if it was $7.99 or $9.99, but it was a higher priced book. We did stock more than we normally would for something like that. But had we known that people were going to be that interested just in the book in general, we would have probably doubled or tripled our order. But we've just seen it time and time again. A great comparison for us would have been was Barrier. Hot creator, Brian K. Vaughan, has had great success with everything he's done at Image. Get the book in. It's that goofy size, and we couldn't give it away. So you just don't know. And unfortunately, the people that were very interested to read the story couldn't get it. DC has not announced plans to print a second printing of Batman Damned. So there's a lot of people now left out in the cold because of everything. So it's just a shame how the whole piece has kind of fallen apart.
How much of that interest do you attribute to, say, getting talked up a lot on the late night talk shows?
Not much, because there's not too many people that are shopping in our demographic for our store that are really paying attention to those late night shows. They're more likely to be binging Netflix or something.
But
fair enough.
That in the zeitgeist publicity has to have. Now, I don't watch any of the late night talk shows either, but again, I heard about all this, and yes, some from the Slack channel and, you know, the forums and stuff, but some from kind of the newspapers, the people talking in the street, the, you know, friends, the office. There has to be some of that.
Oh, I don't deny that there's some of it. I don't deny there's some of it. I just know that for a lot of our customers, they're just more interested in the story being darker and dimmer and different. That was something that intrigued them.
Interesting.
But again, I think we talked about it last time. Our clientele is a little different than a lot of stores. And I think what we might have landed on also last time was that sometimes the clientele more fits the proprietors. So we're, James and I are younger. We've got a younger group of people that frequent our store. We do have all ages and, you know, ethnicities and sexes, you know, represented, but by and large, our main demographic is probably that late teens through mid 30s. So yeah, I guess that age group is, and myself included, probably more drawn to something like Batman Damned, knowing it is separated from the current Batman title. I can get a little bit darker and I don't have to feel guilty like somebody, you know, could see something that I wouldn't want them to see, such as a younger reader. So that was just, that's our store. And I know that we're one of, you know, 3,000 some odd stores.
Well, and I think to your point, every store's got a unique customer base and they're potentially different, you know, commonalities across them. There are going to be some stores like yours that skew to what I would consider kind of a younger demographic. Here in Austin, there's a store or two right near the university that I would expect to have a similar, you know, younger demographic than stores a little further out towards more, you know, where the tech businesses and stuff are, maybe.
Right.
So, and it's good to have stuff out there for all the different audiences. It's just a matter of, are they targeting successfully the audience they're going after? And again, without reprinting something and it sells out or whatever, that's frustrating for everybody.
Yeah. Now, Sam, did you read Batman Damned yet, or do you just have it hanging around the house?
It's hanging around the house. I've kind of skimmed it here and there and went, nope, definitely out. I don't know. It might be good. It might not. I don't have a particular problem with it existing, sort of, but I kind of do. I just,
So let me ask you this. Is the problem the character that they used, or is the problem the tone of the book? Because we had Batman White Knight, which had a similar-ish tone, and it had originally in the art a naked Harley Quinn that was censored. So the naked Harley Quinn never made it out, not in the trade, nothing. Would this be a hot-button issue if it was censored? Because I view this in the very same light that I view Batman White Knight, which is also a Black Label book.
I agree. And again, the White Knight's another book that was suggested to me multiple times. People said it's great. It's not something I'm interested in. And again, I could care less about the image per se. It's just, there's an appropriate place for things. Maybe this is just me. And I've never, I'm trying to figure out. I happen to know several people in the adult entertainment industry. And here's an interesting thing that's come up. Parody in the adult entertainment industry is a very controversial topic among even producers of it. Some people just think it's lazy. Other people just think it's genius because it brings in an audience. And I kind of look at this. There's tons of novels and you can do dark stories and all of those things. And you don't need to go to the mainstream superhero universes to do this. Much like there's plenty of XXX films out there. And you don't need, and again, there are Batman versions of that too. You don't need to go there to make, do you want, if you want a XXX film, you can make a XXX film. If you want a Batman story, you can tell a Batman story. This need to do both at the same time baffles me on multiple levels.
So I'm going to throw one more at you. Arguably one of the top, I would say, five Batman stories in history, if it was created today, would more than likely end up in the Black Label category, and that's The Killing Joke.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Dark Knight Returns, but okay.
No, I'm going to go with The Killing Joke.
Okay.
And, you know, there's images in there. While you don't see full frontal nudity, you see a naked James Gordon.
I could care less about them. And again, Batman Damn thing, I could care less about them. I realize
that seems to be the issue. Right. But if you were to look at The Killing Joke,
yep.
That is an incredibly dark tone.
It is.
It is. I would say that's probably not something you're letting your 7-year-old read either.
I kind of remember. I was about 13, I want to say, when that came out. And I remember having it.
And I think Batman Damned for a responsible, you know, whatever 13-year-old, I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility. I don't feel like there was anything in there that was so far gone that it's not something you would want a young teenager to read.
Sure.
But you wouldn't want a 7-year-old to read it. Sure. It's a little compromising. Same with Killing Joke. And I don't think, like I said, I think you would have to put that in as one of the top. I mean, it's an evergreen title. It's one of the top selling Batman stories that's been told, especially in the modern era. So I guess for me, that's more of a track record to say you can tell those stories. You can tell them in the main line. I think if the frontal nudity in that one panel of Batman Damned wasn't there, this wouldn't be an issue and nobody would care. It would be treated just like the Killing Joke.
Yeah. I think if it had been printed a little darker, it may as well not have been there and people wouldn't have even noticed.
And that, all of that may be true. It's interesting. And again, I read the Killing Joke. It's never been one of my... I love the artwork in it, but that has as much to do with the artist and the talent there as it does the story. Similar artists could have done just as... Brian could have done that on any other Batman story at the time as well.
Sure.
I don't know. I just... Keeping things separated in... Again, I have no problems with anything existing. I really don't. It is the time and the place thing. And there are certain things that, do I want them banned? No. Do they need to be on the front counter in big box stores? No. And again, maybe the comic shop isn't the right place for this type of stuff, particularly with a DC or Marvel logo on
it. I would say, I don't disagree with any of that, but it also, to me, comes down to setting expectations and staying true to the brand, if you will. And I've got, frankly, the same sort of issues around something like Batman Damned. Personally, I didn't think it was a great story for me. I'd much rather read something like White Knight or even Killing Joke. But can people go in and know what to expect? And that takes multiple forms, not just in terms of maturity level or whatever you'd want to call it about the story. I'd argue the same thing with Nightwing, that they've kind of violated the Nightwing brand, if you will, with what they've done to the character. And I think, given how brand aware and sensitive the comic reading audience can be at times, they need to be more cognizant of that and more respectful of that. But it's one of those things that I think that time has passed, because a lot of these companies, particularly Marvel, they set up titles, it's going to go for 18 months, maybe longer if it's lucky, and then they'll pivot and go some other direction. They do that enough, and they've basically run the circle, and they can run it again. If you look at rank 42, we've got what I think is the highest ranking ongoing X-Men title of X-Men Red number 8 with under 40,000 units. I think the only X title above it's Extermination number 3 with 41,800. The X-Men titles are not doing particularly great. They're not doing horrible, but they're not doing great, which is what's leading...
Red is ending with 10.
Well, yeah, because this is all leading up to the new Uncanny X-Men relaunch.
Right.
They're going to pull what they did on the Avengers, merge the titles for a period of time, do a weekly story, and then spin stuff out of that. It's, i.e., time for the pivot. And if you don't know what you're getting into with the X-Men books, or you don't know what you're getting into with a Batman book, or how are they redefining, or how did they define the Black Label and stuff? To me, it's different manifestations of the same kind of core problem of lack of a good identity for either a title, an imprint, or character. And I think that's part of why sales are where they're at on a lot of these things. People don't know what to expect, and by the time they figure it out, the item has changed.
I think for me, the biggest hit on sales are, I think price point is one of it, and I think it's just a cultural shift. We're not a reading culture.
I agree with that entirely.
And I think or if we are a reading culture, we expect it to be 255 characters or less and have a hashtag in it. And I think that is where the bigger struggle for the comics industry lies, is our cultural shift away from reading prose novels, even graphic novels, comic books. People read a lot, but it's all social media. It's short posts. It's Facebook. It's stuff like that. So I think that's really, to me, where the bigger struggle is than what the content is that's out on the shelf. Because I think if you had, if you strip social media out of our current society, if you kind of took us back 20, 25 years, you could throw all these titles out there and you'd have higher numbers because you just have more people absorbing the content.
Yeah, but I think that might have been around the time that the Top Red magazine was TV Guide.
And boy, was it a good read.
Hey, I'll admit I was reading it at the time, but to your point, a lot of the articles were no longer than a page or two.
Yep.
So it's an attention span aspect.
It is an attention span aspect, and I think part of it is a reading aspect. You know, as I've mentioned, I'm a big reader. I love books. I love novels, all that stuff. And it is.
And you're passing that on to your kids. And I know that for a fact because we've talked about it. And I do the same thing with my daughter. You know, we love reading. We're avid readers, but there's a lot of parents that don't do that.
Well, that may, yeah. And again, I'm not making a judgment on whether it's good or it is what it is. I like to read. Some people don't, whatever. I'm not. But what I do find interesting, and this is where, again, I kind of judgmental. If you go on a lot of book sites, you know, places like Goodreads is kind of the one everybody's heard of, but publisher sites, publisher message boards, et cetera, there's this weird battle between readers, like we've always been, and the people that, you know, take a long drive, listen to an audio book and say, oh, I've read that book. And it's not, to me, that's not the same thing.
You know, it's funny because I brought that up ages ago on the podcast about how reading a book and an audiobook were different. And a lot of people assumed that I meant that one was inferior to the other, whereas they're just different experiences.
They're very different experiences. I've tried the audiobook thing personally. I just don't care for it. And maybe this goes to my personal attention span. When I have other things I'm thinking and looking at other than just focusing on the page, I can't follow the story and miss half of it listening via audio.
Yeah. Now, yep.
That's just me personally. And again, it's not better or worse, but there is a point where we talk about things like the movies, the Arrowverse. Is that kind of just the audiobook version of comic books when you get into film and television?
Kind of, sort of. It depends. I mean, some more so than others, because I think with some, they revamp and reimagine the characters so much that it's a derivative work, not kind of an adaptation. And
talking with Batman Dan, they reimagine and rework characters in the comics.
Well, even in Nightwing, which is in the main universe, so yeah. Absolutely. And yes, I'm going to harp on that for a while because it upset me.
Please do. Please harp religiously, nonstop.
I take one of my favorite characters and just think, wow. Anyways. Yeah, I think the view of the TV stuff in particular, or the movies as well, as being the equivalent of an audiobook where it's a different inroad into the world of the characters, or a version of the world of the characters, is a very interesting take and a very legitimate one. And I think it fills it the need for a lot of casual fans. I can't tell you how many people I've known that consider themselves comic fans because they watch the movies, they read the, or they watch the TV shows. They don't read the comics though.
Well, you know, it's hilarious.
Like me saying I'm a football fan because I read Sports Illustrated.
And it's hilarious.
Or because you look at the scores.
But it's hilarious. You mentioned that. This is funny. I had a friend of mine ask me a question, and this is about a year, year and a half ago now, and one of my friends is infinitely proud of this fact. Someone asked me a question about the Inhumans. And mm-hmm. It's been 25 years since I've read those old, old Fantastic Four that started the Inhumans.
Got okay? it.
And they asked me a question about the Inhumans, and I kind of hemmed it off, and I said, if I remember correct, you know, I think this, this, and this, but I'm not really sure. And one of my friends, who always comes to me to ask comic book questions, who watches all the movies and TV shows, said, no, it's this, this, and this. And sure enough, I went, I found my Epic collections, and we looked through them, and they were correct. So it is amazing, in some ways, even though this other friend of mine has never read a comic book in their life, they knew more about the early history of the Inhumans than I did, and that just came from watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., as opposed to me, who after 25 years had forgotten it.
Yeah, but I think that's a stop clock is right twice a day kind of syndrome,
well,
because you ask somebody who's watched the TVs, the cartoons, the movies, you know, who were the original X-Men, depending which show they watched or what movie they watched, they'll give you a different answer.
Absolutely. And like I said, the person didn't like say that, like, I know I'm right, or hey, nothing like, it was just kind of one of those, they came to me and said, hey, by the way, I watched a TV show. This is how it was in the TV show. How
yeah,
is it
and that's
different
fair.
In the comics, and we kind of looked it up, and I went, no, as it turns out, the TV show is closer to what's actually in the comics than what I remember was in the comics.
Well, and what's funny is it may be closer to what the comics originally were than the comic may currently be in some cases.
Also true.
That is highly likely in many cases today.
I mean, I haven't watched the Titans TV show yet, but I'm willing to bet it's Dick Grayson is more like Dick Grayson than the one in Nightwing. So yes, I'm going to keep
harping. You really are harping on that, man.
Oh man, Sam, it's bad. It's bad.
It was too easy to go to for that one. I'm sorry.
I'm not that far behind you guys, but as the Tim Drake fan, instead of the Dick Grayson, my character died years ago.
Tim Drake, I think, was an awesome character, and probably, I was going to say probably the best of the other Robins, but man, Damian Wayne gives him a run for the money. They're both fun in very different ways.
Yep. Tim was the closest to me small version of Bruce.
Yeah, you know, I'm debating if I agree with that or not, because again, Damian is very much a small Bruce, but very much not.
Yeah, Damian's got some things that are very, very different.
He's how Bruce could have gone.
Exactly.
Yeah,
he's the mirror universe young Bruce.
Yes.
Whereas Tim is kind of just young Bruce.
Yeah, but it comes down to when you've got some of these characters that have been around for decades or longer, they've got a certain history to them, and you've either got to stay true to them, or if you want to replace them or whatever, that's fine, but there comes a point where you change the character so much it's literally not the character anymore. And they've done that so many times on so many properties in the comics that I would not be the least bit surprised if there's a sizable contingent of comic fans that are just I'm going to sit this round out and I'll wait for the next revamp. Because they do it so frequently. So I'm curious how the retooling of the X-Men titles, how that's going to go. We'll see that probably not next set of numbers, maybe the one after that, because I don't even think they haven't released the first Uncanny X-Men number one yet.
Right.
But to see all the X-Men books under the 40,000 is not a good sign.
As we're recording this, we are, exactly 1 week away from Uncanny X-Men number one.
Yeah. James and I are going to review that when it comes out. So I have been slowly catching up on the X titles as much as I can, starting with the core X-Men team books. But it goes back to, there's so many of them. And I think that's part of why they're selling where they're selling is red, gold, blue, Astonishing. It would be hard for me to clearly articulate, except for blue, what made each of those titles unique. And blue being the time-displaced young X-Men is the only one I think I could articulate a identity for.
Yeah, and I'm such a DC kid that my X-Men experience... It's pretty much just I steered clear of all the reading because it just felt like too much baggage to jump into. So I have I've been enjoying the Ed Piskor
grand design
work that he's doing. Yeah, that's I kind of feel like I'm getting a Cliff Notes education.
I've only read the first miniseries. I haven't read the second one, but I don't care for the art style. But man, what he has done is utterly amazing. To condense that much history into that small of a package and do so gracefully.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. I was going to use Astonishing. I was going to use Uncanny, but I figured, you know.
you just didn't want to go there.
Yeah. Well, I was trying to think of what's an adjective Marvel hasn't used.
Here's what's really interesting to me. Talking to X-Men fans, which I'm not, I haven't read the book in years. There seems to be a major divide between the people that think red is far superior to all the rest of them and people that feel blue is far superior to all the rest. Do you think this new combined title will make both of those groups happy or turn off one of them?
I think they should just go with X-Men Purple and be done with it. This whole red-blue divide, it's bad for the country. I really don't know if Uncanny is going to be... going to unify on all of that or not. I kind of hope it does, because I think the way they've split the groups is it feels arbitrary. The only other one I would say has a clear identity would be Weapon X, because it's the Black Ops team, because the X-Men need one of those. It's funny, because I really don't consider X-Men Red or X-Men Blue kind of a core franchise leading flagship of the X titles. X-Men Blue because it's time-displaced versions, and X-Men Red because it's not really that many of the key players. Although I guess they've got, you could say, three key X-Men with Jean Grey, Storm, and Nightcrawler. But that's a problem when you've got any franchise that has so many core defining characters that you could literally field half a dozen teams of, you know, six or more characters each and still have not tapped out all of those definitive X-Men or Avengers or Justice Leaguers or whatever. That's when you've just got too many characters.
Yeah, and I guess the piece with Uncanny that's going to be interesting for me is, again, not being deeply versed in the X-Men, it is my understanding from those who I talk to who are that Uncanny X-Men was really, the strength was built around the creator, the writer, essentially. And that was what drew people in. And I think going back to the Uncanny moniker is kind of a way to bring nostalgia of people that were like, oh man, do you remember that title? It was the best title ever. And I really hope for the retailer's sake and especially the reader's sake that whatever, however they take creative direction, they don't try and just do a blatant copy of the existing Uncanny, but they actually stick true to the style because that's what people are going to be expecting. I don't know if that makes sense. It's just like, it's really hard to quote unquote copy perfection.
It's easy to ape it. It's hard to, I don't say reimagine it, reinvigorate it, but to replicate it. I mean, it would be easy to go through the motions of whatever you consider to be the iconic period of any character or team and go through those same motions. But if you don't do it right, it becomes a hollow, soulless kind of incarnation of it versus a recapturing of the glory days.
Yep.
And even if they do that, because you could argue they kind of did that with the that Avengers 16-week run, then when you split the stuff back out to various titles and stuff, do you hang on to it? Because I think that's where Justice League is currently floundering with Odyssey, Dark, and what is the other one? The other forgettable Justice League title that they're going on with coming out of No Justice.
Yeah, there's Justice League Dark and Justice League Odyssey.
I thought there was another one beyond just Justice League. Maybe, I don't know, I've lost track.
I'm racking my brain and I'm not getting it.
Well,
it's been a long week.
Here's the thing. It's going to be tough on the X-Men because, as you pointed out, I don't know if it's the characters. And yes, the characters clearly were loved. But honestly, thinking back through history, other than maybe Jack Kirby in the first 10 years of Marvel, I don't think any creator is as tied to a group of characters as that one.
It's Claremont.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
It just, you know, and at least in the early days of Marvel, I mean, you know, you had Buscema, you had, why am I forgetting?
Well, you had Ditko.
Thank you. Yeah, Ditko and but man, Claremont feels, and yes, obviously he had some great artists, but it felt like he was running that whole show for over a decade.
There are other creators that have had similar tenures on characters that are still fondly remembered, but you're right, it's not the same level of connection as Claremont and the X-Men.
Well, I mean, you did, in a close second place, and I think many people would argue based on when they got into comics, Byrne is also up there for people with X-Men.
I would argue Byrne on Fantastic Four as well.
Yeah, but, yes. Byrne becomes, in the X-Men to me, becomes one of the myriad of wonderful artists that worked with Claremont.
I mean, I'm thinking back to, gets folded like, in. Peter David had a 10-year run on the Hulk. Mark Waid, similar huge run on the Flash.
How long was Busick's run on Avengers?
That's a great question. I'm not sure.
It's at least two omnibus full, because I'm looking at them right now.
Yeah, a good couple of years. But you don't really hear about Busick's Avengers the way you hear about Claremont's X-Men.
Agreed, yeah.
And part of it is Claremont so reinvented the team and gave it kind of that almost second foundation after the original stuff. And well, yeah, there were other key players involved. Don't get me wrong, Len Wein and a few others. But if you were to ask people to remember kind of what they thought were the glory days of the X-Men or those characters or whatever, the majority of them are going to land somewhere in Claremont's run just because it was so authoritative and so long.
I would think that a DC equivalent from a concept, execution, and quality, I would even say, standpoint, but not necessarily the wide notoriety because the title wasn't a flagship team title, would be Geoff Johns on JSA.
Okay, I could kind of see that. I was expecting you to go actually with Byrne on Superman or Wolfman Perez on Titans.
Yeah, you could do Wolfman Perez on Titans for sure. But I was just thinking about taking existing characters, kind of retooling, rebuilding, adding new. I mean, the John's JSA run is phenomenal. But again, it wasn't a flagship. It wasn't Justice League. It was Justice Society. And so it didn't carry quite the same cachet as an X-Men title would, as a top-tier team, always known as top-tier, would be.
Well, it's funny because I think that really builds up the similarities between New Teen Titans, because Wolfman Perez took a lot
Agreed.
Of existing characters, revamped it, added some new ones, and it was kind of the flagship for DC at the time.
I agree with you on Titans. The yep. other thing with Johns is there's enough people that still remember the early Justice League JSA crossovers that kind of predate the John stuff. Plus,
sure.
I'm trying to remember, when is the guy who did Starman did part of that JSA run?
James Robinson.
James Robinson yeah. did part of that run too, and gets Ron Mars and Peter David even did parts of that X-Men run we're talking about at times, different books in it. But it just, for some reason, Claremont's the person everyone remembers as doing everything, even though that wasn't necessarily true.
Well, even what he didn't do, he had his hands kind of in. He was the creative godfather of the X-Men franchise for so long. And it was a really good run.
Yeah. And again, like you mentioned with the Titans, Wolfman Perez made the Titans. Those characters pre-exist, much like the X-Men pre-exist. But
mm-hmm.
no one...
They redefined them. And yeah.
Nobody remembers the Lee Ditko X-Men.
They do, but in a very different way
yeah.
than the Claremont X-Men. This is why when the stuff is getting adapted to film and even to TV with The Gifted, what they're drawing on tends to be from the Kirby... Or not the Kirby, the Claremont era, not the early days of Lee and Kirby and such.
And again, I think he's just such a long history and such... on a massive amount of cultural awareness. Arguably, Kurt Swan's tenure on Superman is up there with anything in comics history. But again, he doesn't have that kind of notoriety like Claremont does, or connection.
I would agree with all of that. It's funny because I would be hard-pressed to name anything, say, on this current list where I feel a character is getting that kind of iconic, defining run by a current creator. And maybe it's too soon to tell on some of this. Some of it's more obvious in hindsight.
Sure, Walking Dead. That is all Robert Kirkman. And yes, I realize...
that's an excellent example.
What's his name's been there for quite a while as the artist...
Adler.
And I think people... But again, people remember Tony Moore. He's still listed as a creator. But that's kind of the closest thing I can think of on this list.
Yeah, because it is a... obviously a defining run, and not one that anyone is ever, I mean, nobody else is going to take over the title, nor should they. Although, man, if Kirkman could pass the baton successfully on that, man, hats off to him on that. I don't see that happening. I don't necessarily want to see that happen, but you're right. That's one of the few things that where we've got a creator that's gotten that kind of a tenure on a current book and has that kind of, defining run, although it's obvious since Kirkman created the book, but we're seeing it play out on, you know, the TV screen and stuff like that. Granted, in different ways or whatnot, but...
Oh, I almost forgot. Way down there, one of my favorite books, 229. Larry Hama and G.I. Joe are also synonymous with each other. They just are.
Yes, I would agree with that. It'd be interesting if you were to take a list of creators and pull a wide enough sampling of comic readers, both casual and hardcore, and say, okay, list the one property they're best known for, or that you associate most with them, or however you would phrase that question, kind of what you would get for a lot of people.
I'd think it would be entertaining to do the same thing for artists.
Yeah.
Because you'd have, you talk about Todd McFarlane, you could have people that would say Spider-Man, you'd have people that could say Spawn, you could even have some people that would say Batman. He did very limited Batman work, but for a DC-only person, that's what they're going to say.
Yeah, and it comes down to when were you reading, what were you reading, and where were you focused?
As a guy who read and owns every one of those issues of his from all three of those properties, I'd probably still say Batman.
I'd probably say Spawn.
Yeah.
And I'd say Spider-Man.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with any of them.
Exactly. But that's kind of the cool thing about it.
But to me, Batman always set the stage for Smallville. Batman.
Didn't he also do Infinity Inc.? I think he did. I could be wrong. Sorry.
It's weird because that era of Spider-Man, I know McFarlane's the one everybody remembers. I tend to think of that as the Eric Larson era more than the Todd McFarlane era.
Yeah. Again, it comes down to which creators kind of hit your radar and stuff the most. Because I can't tell you how many times I've done a review of a given book. It's like, I don't recognize this name. And somebody will chime in. It's like, yeah, but you've read everything he's done. He's done this, he's done this, he's done this, he's done this. I'm like, oh, yeah, I just can't get the name right. So name recognition is a very interesting thing. So there are a lot of people that are kind of that journeyman level where they're doing awesome stuff and just not quite getting the credit for it. And there are others that are doing less, but man, everybody knows their name. And sometimes it's because it's better stuff. Sometimes it's just higher profile, not necessarily intrinsically better.
And just to give John the pat on the back, yes, Tom McFarlane did do the pencils on issues 13 through 37 of Infinity Inc.
Wow.
The part that stood out in my mind for those is he would do kind of, I don't say a framing sequence on the page, but there would be... I mean, it was basically set up to where he could sell the some of the art pages for big bucks, because there'd be a full render of one of the characters, just, you know, and then a couple of panels of the story or whatever. So a very different page design than we had gotten really before or since. And I loved Infinity Inc. One of the many, 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 many books I wish DC would bring back. So what else on the list looked interesting to you guys? We got Fantastic Four number 2 having dropped, yes. Let's see, what, nearly 300,000 units.
I don't think that was a shock to anyone.
I believe you predicted it a month ago.
Yeah, yeah. And it's still over 85,000 units. So, I mean, I need to read that issue. I haven't read that. But, yeah, there are certain sales that are just unsustainable. I'm curious how this title is going to kind of land when it levels off.
Venom's still climbing. There is something going on with that character, and it's not just the movie.
No, it's the book.
They're doing some really good stories.
Yeah.
Behind, but what I've read, matter of fact, James and I reviewed one of them, and it's like, wow, this is a very different approach to the character, and it works.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing with Venom is there's constant movement on the title. Like, there's constant movement in the story. You can tell it's being written for an arc, but it's not like, it doesn't have that slow, trudging pacing for the arc. There's a lot of things happening, so it's a full, rich experience, and I think a lot of people are finding that and enjoying it. The other thing that Marvel's been doing is they've been continuing to reprint and add more printings. I think they're up to their fifth or sixth printing of the first issue. Now some of that is manufactured collectible, but it's also offering stores the ability to bring it in and keep it on the shelf. So I think that having a steady influx is very helpful, whereas you go over to DC and almost all of their titles, once they're out, they're out. They're not reprinting them. So it's helping keep momentum by being able to stock the shelves.
I think having that reorder activity and, again, the reprints to facilitate it is just a smart move.
Yeah, and there's two different philosophies. So Marvel's philosophy is we're going to create a new cover. We're going to announce that there's a second, third, fourth, whatever print. Based on sales of the last one. So say they did an 8,000 print run on the last one and sold out in a week. Well, there's probably enough demand to do another print run. DC tells you to go in and put in reorders that sit in the backorder limbo. And most retailers have been bitten so badly by this in the past that we don't do it. Because what happens is, in the moment, we'll go in and we'll say, I'd like to reorder 12 copies. Well, you get 1,000 retailers that do that. All of a sudden, you've got 12,000 demand. They're going to pop that printing. But it could be a month. It could be 8 months. And so what has happened in the past is people would do that, and a publisher would, not just DC, but any publisher would say, well, we've built up enough. Let's go ahead and reprint that. As a retailer, it's 6 months past. Nobody gives a crap anymore. But you put that reorder in, you are bound to buy those books because you've already committed to it. So most people don't go in and do that. And DC keeps telling us, well, you have to go in and put in for reorder if you want us to print another printing. And we're just like, fine, we're just not going to be able to carry it because we're not going to get bit and burned.
Yeah, I think that's a bad process. And I agree with you not doing that. I've had times in the past before I went mail order and stuff, I'd miss an issue, whatever. It's like, hey, can you get another copy? Oh, well, we'll put in for a back order, whatever. Nothing, ever.
Right.
And in by the time it, if it ever did come, they would have forgotten I was the one who'd asked for it and stuff. It's just, it's a horrible
system. Or you probably picked it up at a con or, you know, were traveling and visited a different shop or whatever.
Or forgot that I needed it, maybe.
Or got it online. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. There comes a point where really at that point, if you've missed it, you're better off going to, again, like you said, a convention, an online back issue dealer or something like that, and just seeing who has it. But I really think where we've seen some strength in the last couple of months is the amount of reorder activity we'll see on certain titles, where it's not just, hey, there's a bunch on one issue, but like we'll see the last three or four issues or something. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's still moving through the system is a great sign.
Yep. Yeah, and the content creation for subsequent printings gets cheaper and cheaper every time because the interior is already done.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's, again, where I think supporting some of the stuff Marvel does with their True Believers line is just a smart move as well.
Absolutely.
And I think they timed their run of the Venom stuff, I forget if that was last month, month before, whenever, close enough to when the title was launching and when the movie was coming out and stuff that it was, or maybe it's next month, I forget. I don't get the True Believers stuff, but I think it's a great line of books that they do. This is where I think DC's leaving money on the table by not doing something similar mindset.
Dumb question. Venom number 6 is on this list. Has the trade come out yet, Eric?
Ooh, I believe it's been solicited. I have not seen it come in yet, but let me do a quick search here. I've got the Diamond stuff up. It comes out in 2 weeks.
So it'll be
the 21st.
Okay, so it'll be in the November numbers.
Yep, and it is issues 1 through 6, 144 pages, $17.99.
Has Marvel slowed down a little on releasing the trades? Because it used to be that they would solicit the trade at the same time as the final issue it collected, and it seemed like it'd come out almost on the heels of it.
Let's see. So this Venom by Donny Cates trade paperback volume 1 has an August order code, and if we go to Venom 6,
July.
That has a July.
Okay, so they waited till the next previews. That's not bad.
Yeah, so they staggered it by a month, which then leads to a 2-month gap between the issue hitting the shelves and the trade hitting the shelves, and I attribute a lot of that to the printing process. That's a little bit more time intensive for glue binding and additional pages.
That's fair.
Do we want to look at rank 20? And is this going to work? Is this really a comic? A TV adaptation?
I haven't read this. It's Stranger Things number 1 at 60,134 units. Have either of you guys read it?
Nope.
It will not hold.
How not holding will it be? I mean, like 30,000, 10,000, 5,000?
I'm going to say 40,000, 25,000, 18,000.
Okay, much less important than the actual number guess. Why? You said that very quickly. Is it particularly bad, or do you just think it was a novelty to begin
with? It was a novelty to begin with, and the people that have read it have said, meh, okay. not that good. So it was a novelty to start. Each one of these has four covers, and the fourth cover on each of them is a photo cover from the show. So it's definitely playing off it's not a content-driven thing, I guess is what I'm saying. In some cases, very much like the Rick and Morty versus Dungeons and Dragons, it has an independently orderable A and B, and the B cover is a D&D stat sheet.
Which, yeah, we talked about last month. Yeah.
Yep.
How'd those do for at least you?
Continuing to do strong. Good. At least those B covers.
Yeah, whenever something's not kind of driven by the content, that's never a good sign.
No. I mean, I think they intended for Stranger Things to be driven by the content, but I think that there's an aspect that the show has, which is more than just the script. It's the ambiance and the aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to have that come through in a silent medium is a little bit more difficult.
I agree. There's some shows or movies that intangible quality of the delivery or the visual or something can be really hard to replicate in a comic.
Now, I will say Paper Girls can set some... Brian K. Vaughan and Cliff Chang, they have been able to set some pretty cool kind of scenes, and you get the vibe. So I think part of it, too, is how it's done creatively. Not to say it can't be done. It's just takes a very different skill.
Yeah, I think almost anything can be done in almost any medium with a couple of obvious exceptions or whatever, but the skill you need to pull it off, and it's a very fine line between knocking it out of the park and just a complete train wreck.
Yes.
I see there was a bunch of returnability on this first issue. Is that continuing? Did that influence, like, your decision, how many to order, Eric, et cetera, et cetera?
On Stranger Things? We kind of just ordered what we felt was going to be, I don't know, the number to go for. In order to make it returnable, you had to order 20 or more copies of any combination covers A through D. So there was a minimum buy-in. But let me check. This is Dark Horse, so they aren't. Okay, so publishers are doing all sorts of different things with returnability right now. And it's actually kind of an interesting little topic to bring up. So we may jump off of Stranger Things, but sure. I'll bring it back. So Stranger Things, Dark Horse tends to do kind of a methodology, depending on the title, order 10 or more, and this title is returnable. Order 20 or more, this title is returnable. We saw DC do returnability with Man of Steel as kind of a way to help try and flood the shelves, get more people excited and interested. Boom has what's called Boom Guaranteed for retailers that are considered a part of their retailer guarantee program. And select titles each month, first issues and sometimes second issues, are 100% fully returnable. No minimum buy-in, no whatever. So we do see that, which is one way of doing it. Valiant will do stuff on some of their bigger books, like the Bloodshot that had the 1-in-250 glass cover.
Mm-hmm.
You order a certain threshold, and those are 100% returnable. And then you've got what IDW is doing, which is really kind of a, I don't know. It's basically they're offering free returnability, or not free. They're offering returnability on books, but you have to pay 20 cents per copy to return it.
So not so, totally returnable, but lower risk.
Yeah, enough to make, I think, most every retailer say, that's okay, I'll just order what I need and not take that extra leap of faith.
Yeah, I can see that.
So every publisher is doing it differently. Every publisher, at least in our store, gets treated differently as such. Boom, we have a really great rapport with the publisher top to bottom. We know everyone from the sales group to their lead publisher to who handles their printing components. So all of that, we are willing to go a little bit heavier in on Boom titles because we know as soon as we send that return claim, it's instantly processed. There's no problems. Dark Horse, we typically don't do, we haven't historically done a lot of sales with Dark Horse books, so we're not willing to push the envelope quite as hard. So for us, we ordered relatively close to what we felt the need would be. And I think as far as returnability goes, we'll probably end up returning less than 10 copies of Stranger Things number one total, which represents probably 15 to 20% of what we brought in.
Okay.
So not too bad. Man of Steel, that was a case where we went super heavy on it because we knew it was going to be a big launch. There was the Bendis push, you know, no issues there. And then Valiant is very different because with that 1-in-250 glass cover, we had somebody order the glass cover. So that instantly right there put us at that threshold where we hit returnability. So that was nice. And then they had additional variants along the way. I think there was a 1-in-50, a 1-in-25. So it was kind of like this multiplier effect of, you know, we bring it in and we sell it. And if it just doesn't do good, okay, we're not, you know, collecting dust in the back room. So each publisher does it differently. But it specifically to Stranger Things, like I said, we'll return some, but we didn't go super heavy just because they had returnability.
Well, okay. This may seem like a dumb question, but you said Dark Horse does this, and you said in this particular case, it was order 20 or more. And you said they sometimes do it with 10 or more. We're talking about a $4 item. Assuming 50% gross margin, maybe that's a little generous, maybe it's a little, whatever. You're talking, that's a $50 and $25 MOQ to order these. If you can't meet a $50 MOQ or particularly a $25, why?
What's an MOQ?
Minimum order quantity, sorry.
Ah, okay,
why even bother? I don't know.
So most stores won't bother to hit that 20. They'll just get what they need and call it good.
Okay, let me rephrase that. If you can't sell 20 of a $4 item, I almost hate to say it, are you in the right business?
Well, again, you've got to consider how many comics are out there. Yeah. You can't order that many of everything.
And on top of that, you have to look also at markets and different shop sizes. So there's a comic store that's about 45 minutes to an hour away from us. We sell more comics in a week than he probably sells in 2 months. But he does fine. He's still plodding along. And it's all based on market. And his store is predominantly Marvel readers. So he's not going to go. He's going to get, you know, 3 copies of Stranger Things, number one. One for the guy that ordered it and 2 for the shelf to see if anybody wants it.
Yeah.
And what the math that you did, yeah, that makes total sense to do. But when you multiply it across the number of items and the fact that you have to order this months in advance, sight unseen, and you have to pay up front, you don't get it like, some bookstore markets where the product comes in and then you're paying based on what you sold and then sending the rest back. I mean, we're cash up front.
Yeah.
Now, so you're basically giving the publishers a loan.
And maybe I just deal in different types of products. I mean, again, the type of products I deal in, $4 MSRP, I'm like, whatever, give me $1,000 and we'll see what happens. But
yeah, your sales volume, though, is probably
much different than your average comic store.
I was going to say your sales volume could, maybe not, but could equal out almost the entire comics industry, depending on what industry you're in, right?
Fair enough.
So split what you're doing by 3,000 people and then maybe.
Well, yeah. Remember, I'm a manufacturer. But yes, when you're selling to big box stores and stuff, you know, I've got MOQs too, but they're in the thousands.
Right.
Yeah, I think it comes down to the fact that, you know, most comic stores are small businesses. And again, we've got a list 5,000 deep here, and that's not even everything that came out in the month. You know, there's just so many things. And even if it...
Yeah, 500 deep, sorry. Yeah.
Well, there's 5,000 things in the previews catalog every month. How about that? But yes, 500 things coming out. There's a ton of stuff. And even if the essentially loaning the publisher the money aside, and that's a huge thing to set aside, just the trouble it would take to keep up on all of that and process the returns and stuff, I don't know that I would bother with it even if it was a financially viable thing to do.
Yeah, and don't forget, we have to rip the covers off and we get to pay to ship them back after we fill out the affidavit forms. I mean, it's not as, I should say, Boom makes it very easy. For Boom, all it is you write down how many you're returning, and then it's literally on your honor, and it's a fantastic system. They are fantastic people. Certain publishers, you got to jump through certain hoops for, so it's really a case-by-case basis.
It's a fantastic system, so, you know, there's lots of Boom books with no covers or whatever on you.
It just takes a few retailers to kind of game the system and ruin it for everybody.
Yeah, and so far, and they do keep a watch on that. You're not, they do kind of have some eyes on it. If they see some egregious numbers, you know, like for 3 months in a row, you've ordered 100 of every book and you've returned 98 of every one of them, they're going to kick you out of the program.
It's not a winning proposition for them.
No, and we were talking to them at the last retailer summit, because we do have a good relationship with them. Morgan's like, oh my gosh, hey guys, how are you doing? And we were just kind of chatting. She's like, you're not taking advantage of us enough. And we're like, what?
Yeah, no, you guys told that story on your podcast.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it was one of those things where, they basically said, like, you know, order a couple extra. We'd rather have them available for people to buy than for you guys just stretching that little bit extra to think that you know, you're going to get what you cover.
That reminds me of something one of the guys at Valiant had said a good couple of years ago at Comic-Con. Of, you know, he wasn't wanting to double their sales of any of their books, but if you're ordering 10, order 11 or 12. Get that next copy. Incrementally do it. You multiply that out across, again, the 2,000-3,000 or whatever comic shops out there. That adds up.
Right.
And it's a smarter way to grow your business than slap a variant cover on it, double the sales or triple the sales for 1 month, and then go straight back to where you were.
Right.
But some of these publishers are clearly trying to sell based on their content and their value proposition versus, you know, the collectability of a given cover.
It would be a smart move if it worked, but we don't
Fair enough.
We don't see that it works. I mean, Valiant, you know, as an example, said that. We haven't seen a 5-10% increase in their books month over month since they said that.
No, I don't think we've ever seen that.
And we keep seeing a decrease. So at that point, you go, oh, no, let's do the variant cover thing and, you know, sell the extra 20 and cover, you know, another 3 issues worth of drops.
Flip side, though, if you've got something that admittedly may have a niche audience and you satisfy that audience, you'll do okay. Rank 111, we've got Mighty Morphin Power Rangers 31 doing nearly 21,000 units. They got really good word of mouth within the Power Ranger community of this is good stuff with the Shattered Grid stuff. They then followed it with a switch of creative teams in different direction, but still, it's got some momentum behind it now because its target audience is happy with it, which is, I think, a marked difference from what you were saying, Eric, about Stranger Things and the feedback you've gotten on that.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got fans of the property and they're like, eh, it's okay, that's not a good sign. So what else do we got in here that looks interesting?
Dumb question, John. Down at rank 116, Champions number 24, up 20%. Eric, John, anybody have an explanation?
No, I looked into that one. I have no clue. There's no variance. It was just one cover. I don't read Champions, so I am in the dark on this one.
I have not read that one, so I cannot answer that.
Champions grapple with a foe that all the superpowers in the world cannot vanquish. There's a some derivative of a Spider-Man on the cover. Yeah.
It'd be Miles it's still in that stock. Would be on the cover, I would think.
I think it is Miles, yeah. But it's still in stock at Diamond if anyone needs a copy.
So it increased in sales and they printed more, so obviously they had 90s. In theory.
With that kind of a bump, I would expect there to be a variant cover on it, but because sometimes they do those late in the game, but Eric, I would have expected you to know about that if that were the case.
Yeah, I'm in the Diamond system, searching for all, out of stock, back orderable, available soon, in stock, Champions 24, there is one cover.
Huh. Yeah, there are occasionally times where it's like, why the hell did this do this?
And nobody knows.
And, well, sometimes it's obvious, yeah. Oh, it's a guest star, it's a variant cover, it's this gimmick, that gimmick, whatever. There are other times it's like, I have no idea.
Rank 160, Fantastic Four number one reorder.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
For as much as we talked about the crazy, almost 80% drop, obviously there was something to this book. It's got some interest. Eric, as you're a month and a half ahead of this list, what's the word of mouth on this book?
I don't think that it is. It's not bad. Okay. It's also not, you know, lighting the world on fire. It's one of those things where I think you've got a contingent of FF fans who are excited the title is back, and a contingent of slot fans that want to see how this is going to move forward. So right now it's just, I think, still in a state of wait and see. But that's about what I know. I also am looking right now to see how many potential subsequent printings have happened. I've got 18 pages of Fantastic Four number one that I'm trying to comb through real quick. I do know that there was a substantial amount of reorder because this FF1 had a series of four Art Germ independently orderable covers, and two of them were just rife with massive amounts of bindery issues from the printing. And I know there's a lot of reorder on those, but obviously those won't fill if they aren't in stock. Good golly, 18 pages, holy Moses.
There comes a point where, again, this thing started with a bazillion covers and whatnot, so...
There we go. Yeah, there's a second printing came out August 29th, is still in stock.
So that would be probably what most of this is.
I'm thinking.
Okay.
Is it less than 10,000?
It's 12,000.
Okay, so yeah, probably maybe a little bit of a mix. There was also the third printing was canceled.
Well, what's interesting is
so there was
some
interest, but not that much.
Well, this is the item code for the Fantastic Four Art Germ cover. And what they tend to do is use what they consider the most recent one, which typically would not have been, in this case, that one. It would have probably been the blank cover because it's the max. Yeah, the way they pick the item code they use for listing this is a little not to my liking.
Yeah.
So that implies it might have been something to do with the printer error.
Yeah, could be. It's hard to tell.
Which cover specifically was it?
Well, the 07731 is the item code for the original listing on the Art Germ Mr. Fantastic variant.
Yep, that was one of the ones that had the mega printing issues. It was that one and the Torch were the two bad ones.
Torch would be 0776 for the item code, and this is listed as multiple, so it could be a combination of the two. It's hard to tell.
Yep.
Well, plus the second printing.
Yeah. They used to do the item code listing differently, where they would do a dash and give you the list of the item codes. But you could tell with this, where there was like a bazillion covers, it would have been impractical to do that. So they shifted that many years ago. But it loses visibility as to what all is included in this aggregate line item. It's going to be interesting, though, to see if we get continued reorder activity on this. I don't expect we will. And again, like I said earlier, where is it going to kind of start to stabilize? Because the sales of number two at the, 85,000 or something, by and large, not a sustainable number these days, even with the pent-up demand for the team.
Now, if you go down to line one, quantity rank 191, retail rank 181.
Mm-hmm.
That Venom reorder, that code is specific to the third printing of Venom number 3, which was a new cover, a Stegman variant. So that one is specific to a new printing. And I'm guessing we will probably see that with the rest of these Marvel reorders.
Well, if you go down towards the bottom of the top 300, you'll see several of the early Amazing Spider-Mans too.
Yep. Those have been getting 4th, 5th. I think I might have had a 6th printing come in yesterday.
Yeah, when we start to see that many kind of subsequent or consecutive issues or whatever of reorder, to me that really shows some interest, hopefully in the comic, perhaps just in the cover.
Yep, all the way down to X-23 at quantity rank 442, that was a second printing cover.
You know, I find it interesting that Marvel is doing the second printings and stuff, because there was a point, and I'm going to say 10 or 15 years ago, possibly longer, where they were essentially using scare tactics of order it now, we're not going to reprint anything or overprint anything. And for the pendulum to have swung essentially across Marvel and DC to flip positions almost. Not that DC's using the scare tactics, but again, they're not really that aggressive on the additional printings.
Right.
It just shows how the views within the publishers shift over time.
Right. Actually, John, I have one thing I want to talk about. Quantity rank 212.
Okay.
And I'm still relatively new at looking at all these charts. So this is Wrong Earth by Ahoy Comics.
Yes.
This was a book that we had that retailers got a double ship of. So if you ordered 5, they sent you 10. Do they mark that in here anywhere?
Sort of.
Like, would you know if that 8,248 was the true order or was that the doubled order?
I would say that's the true order, not the doubled order, but I'm not 100% certain.
Was it ridiculously discounted?
Well, no, essentially, the other half was free.
Yeah, the other half was free.
Which is why the retail rank is so low. I'm assuming the estimated units is based off the quantity rank number. I mean, I know it's based off the percentage, but I'm assuming the percentage is based off the quantity rank number. And with that retail rank, I'm assuming that means that number is twice.
They counted all of them.
You're right. I hadn't caught the retail ranking. I had blurred it with the one above it. Yeah, that would put it
about 4,100 for real orders, which would put it somewhere down in the 290s as far as quantity rank.
Maybe even a little below that.
291 was 4,119. Be somewhere right around there. So okay.
Yeah, that's why it's good to have the retail rank, because it shows where that kind of stuff is happening. And I think it's a good move for them to, you know, overship and get more copies out there, figuring retailers may have been conservative or whatever, and to share the risk. But it's also a way to, arguably, if they were trying to game the chart here, not that there's any reason they would want to, because, I mean, who cares?
Especially at that rank. If you're going to game the chart to make the top couple, it's one thing. To make 212 is kind of pointless.
I think it was, just from what I'm gathering from the publisher, I think it was totally a push for, we're trying to do the right thing, you know, by you guys, give you a little extra juice to try and get some traction. And it was so funny because we got them and we pulled them out and we were setting them out on our tables. And so James has one account. I have another account. His accounts are in store. Mine's for the mail order. And we set all our books out. We, you know, do the whole, see what we're shorted, see what's damaged, etc. But the best part was we both had these big stacks of Wrong Earth. And on some books, depending on what they are, if we have somebody in the store that's buying like a 1 in 50 or a 1 in 100 variant, and nobody from mail order is buying a variant, we'll shift all of my A copies over to James's account or vice versa. We'll do it the other way. And so both of us almost at the exact same time picked up our stacks of Wrong Earth and went over to the other person and said, I think we must have put all these on mine. Here's yours. And we were both holding a stack of Wrong Earth to one another. And we're like, what the heck's wrong with this picture? You know, we didn't order this much. And then we went to the invoice and we're like, ah, they gave us a double for free. But it was just like, it was that moment of us standing there with all these books going, what the hell do we do with these?
Since you divide your orders that way, has there been any time where you look at his stacks of the comics and stuff, and you look at your stack of the comics, and there's one pile that's just completely off-kilter from the other guys? In other words, is there a point where the in-store sales of one thing are just doing gangbusters better than the mail order vice versa?
Mail order, I do a ton more of... I do a ton more Batman and the Batman variant.
Okay.
I do a ton more Detective. Trying to think what other ones off the top of my head I'm trying to visualize. James does more Star Wars in the store than I do mail order. I do a lot more Aftershock in general than what the store does. But I do that aggressive bundle because we really want to support Aftershock. We believe in what they're doing and we like working with them. Oh, what the heck is it? There was one book that I had a big stack of. Oh, what was it? It was not that long ago. Basically, the DC books that have the variants, I tend to do more than the store does. Like Harley. Same thing with Wonder Woman with the Jenny Frison covers. Oh, Walking Dead. I do probably triple the Walking Dead through mail order than what John does. And some of that is attributed to people like Drew and Kyle who will get like multiple copies of the A and the B covers because they're putting together runs that they sell and stuff like that. But
yeah,
so I do quite a bit more. But yeah, no, by and large, our stacks are fairly relative. So like if I've got 10 of a copy, it's an equal percentage across my books as what James would have percentage for that copy for him.
That was kind of what I was getting at, as I would expect, since you're not as geographically limited in your client base for the mail order, sure, you may sell more of this, that, or the other, because maybe people can't find, you know, Aftershock in their local area or whatever.
I certainly sell a lot more title count than James does.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely do I sell more title count. I'm probably getting close to 2-to-1.
But you don't have the shelf
titles
space
for what he has.
You don't have the shelf exactly space problem.
Yeah.
Right. For me, I am... You know, I try and account for some damages along the way and have a little bit of a buffer, but by and large, I am a 100% sell-through.
Mm-hmm.
So,
it's a different business model.
Backing up just a touch, Ahoy Comics got a lot of talk on the Slack channel and everything and being a little out of it the last month or so. I've never even heard of this group. What's going on? Somebody talk to me. What's Ahoy?
They're a new publisher that has come out with, let's see, Wrong Earth is basically... Take the
is that the one
Adam
you,
West?
Yeah, you reviewed this with James.
It's essentially taking the Adam West Batman and the grim and gritty movie Batman and swapping them on Earths.
Okay.
Then there's Captain Ginger, which James has read that I have not. That's a Star Trek cat kind of thing. And then there is I'm trying to remember what's High Heaven.
Yep.
That we also reviewed.
I have to admit, I rolled my eyes when I saw Captain Ginger, but I paged through it, and it was actually kind of entertaining.
Was I remember James said it was really good.
Yeah. It is kind of it's clever. I'll say that. It's clever.
That one I haven't checked out yet, but I'm curious. So, yeah, they're new publisher trying to make their way.
And they've got backups in their book, and I know Grant Morrison's been in a couple of those, maybe all three, but I can't remember. So there's a little bit of cachet with Grant being on board, and I don't know if Ahoy is obliquely tied in with the heavy metal stuff that Grant's running, or if it's just pure happenstance. It's too coincidental that he's on a couple of these books doing backups, so there's got to be a tie somewhere with something.
Yeah.
he's kind of a busy guy, so I wouldn't think that he would just go, oh, some little brand new publisher, I'll jump in and do a little something for him.
He may just believe in what they're doing and try to help them too. You never know.
He might have some ownership sort of stake in them too.
That's what I'm wondering, if he doesn't have something like that.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see how Ahoy does, because I really think kind of the first book out for a new publisher, it doesn't necessarily set a high watermark, but it sets a benchmark. Sometimes they can pass that, often they can't. And I think it's just a tough market for a new publisher to get into.
And I'll say, you know, honestly, it's all about the content. Now, Aftershock started off with just a couple titles, but by and large, their creators they're on that B to A list creator name side. You got Donny Cates, you got Marguerite Bennett, you've got Garth Ennis. You know, these are not could be's or has been's. These are relevant names that have some pretty good cachet and titles behind them. And are they lighting up the charts at 40, 50, 60,000 copies? No, but they're steady Eddie between those 6 to 10,000 copies. And on top of that, they're doing good in trades, and all the press and the buzz that we see from the internal view is all incredibly positive with Aftershock. And now Aftershock is getting into the mixed media component of things, which was what Joe told us when he came out to our shop with Garth, was that was the whole game plan. So Aftershock is going to be doing the screen adaptation of God Country by Donny Cates. So, I mean, they really are kind of moving forward at a very in a strong position from where I sit.
Screen adaptation.
Great creators.
Screen adaptation. What do you... Are they a production company? Are they working with a studio? What are you talking? I'm trying to understand what that means.
Yeah, so Aftershock is going to be handling the adaptation. I want to make sure I say this correctly here. So, Legendary Entertainment and Aftershock Media are optioning the Image comic property God Country. And that's pretty much all they've written so far, but it's our understanding that Aftershock will be... They don't have the studio, but they will be the ones kind of doing the running of the adaptation, working with Donnie on the script and kind of owning the actual licensing and production, post-production work, I guess.
Post-production work. Wow.
Making sure that it's all adapted correctly and set to go. Not doing necessarily the filming, but doing a lot of that other multimedia work. So they've got big plans. Now... I could
they've
be
got a big back.
Grabbing a. They do. They've got some very big okay. backers.
See, none of that's cheap, so they've clearly got someone or someone's with some deep pockets.
Interesting. Well, that may, you know, help them out in the long term, because I think, like I said, it's comics is a rough business to get into. So start with a lot of money and work your way down to a stable small company if you're lucky.
Yep. Let's see. I did have a couple other little notes. There were a couple of pieces of DC books that are continuing to slowly climb, fully 100% attributable to the variant covers. That's the Batgirl with Middleton variants, and then Red Hood 26 had a Yasmine Putri variant, and we should see another little bump for 27 with the Putri variant, and then I believe Yasmine is going to be moving over to Nightwing. So we can expect to potentially see a little bit of a variant bump there as well going forward in the next 2 to 3 months. And then I have two others, X-Men Blue 36. That one had a jump of, get the right number here. X-Men Blue 36 had a jump of 15%, 4,000 copies. That was the final issue. It had featured a third variant, which wasn't open to order, but it was a Wills Portacio variant that I think might have been an FOC-based thing. Let me do that quick research. I didn't jot all these things down. I should have. No, that one was actually solicited regularly. So, but it did have three final issue covers, two final variants, one being Portacio and the other one being an all-red. So that jumped that one up a little bit with the extra variant. And then the other one that I saw was Ice Cream Man number 7, which is Ice Cream rank 209. That one went up 12.43%. And this one is attributable to, again, variants. This one had was one of the last ones out of the gate for the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund variants that Image did, both a censored and uncensored. And I think consensus around at least mail order customers was that this cover was probably the most hysterical because the it featured the ice cream man wearing a dress and lifting it up just a little bit and showing some bare ankle. The censored version had a censored bar over his ankle, and the uncensored had his ankle being shown. It was very hysterical. So that one got a lot of laughs, and a lot of people bought that just because they thought it was very clever without being grotesque or explicit.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I think it's funny because some months I'll go through and I'll see some of these bumps and I'll go itemize. Well, it had these bazillion different covers and stuff. Other months, it's frankly, that's a lot of work. You know, particularly when you hit one of these Fantastic Fours that's got, you know, over a dozen or whatever.
It's a lot easier when you've got the back end of the Diamond system to look at.
Yeah, I imagine. I just wind up pulling up the retailer order form for the month frequently. And then, man, the number of covers some of these have, it's just staggering.
But, one that I want to look at that's actually right next to Ice Cream Man is Curse Word 16. That one had a 25% jump. And that also had the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund censored and uncensored variants.
Yeah, because that was a theme for some of the variants that month, I believe.
Yep. And that, yeah. Yep, that was an Image thing. So those bumps are where they can be attributed to. Oh, Hackslash Resurrection down at 251. That was the same thing. I know that for sure. So, yeah.
It's disappointing how few comics are actually going up on any given month over the previous issue. And then how many of those are so easy to attribute to some of these kinds of variant covers. I mean, it makes sense. I get why they do it. It'd just be nice if a little bit more of this was based on the contents.
Yeah, I mean, I think a content-driven bump that you're seeing is quantity rank number 58, Oblivion Song,
mm-hmm.
up 11%, up 3,000 copies. I mean, that's totally based on content. There's really no gimmicks there.
Yeah, it can and does happen. It's just much more the exception than the rule.
Yeah.
If we look at the price points, there's really not all that many price points at play. And it looks like I did not resort this after I filtered out all the price points that weren't there. So give me a sec to do that real quick. $3.99 is the popular price point. And it accounts for over 78% of the items. There's really only about what?
$4.99 is twice as popular as $2.99 now, and even the $1 books are more popular than the $2.99.
Yeah, well, and only about a little over 11% is over $3.99 for the top 300. And that really doesn't change significantly for the top 500, it only goes to about 13.2%, not counting the one at $4, because it's effectively $3.99. So, yeah, the $3.99 price point is here to stay until $4.99 takes over. And, yeah, $2.99 is just falling away, which is a shame. It was going to happen. And, frankly, probably long overdue, given how long the $3.99 price point had been around. So the resistance we had seen to the $3.99 price point, it put up a good fight. It just, time takes its toll.
Well, and in the top 10, you got 40% over $3.99. And even in the top 20, you got 37% over $4.99. I mean, over $3.99, sorry. So not only is it not, well, you point out that it's only 11%, it is the most popular books.
It's 11% of the items, but it's probably a lot more of that in terms of the units.
Yes, clearly. Again, just looking at the top 20. You can see
that. But when they've got something that they can claim is arguably an event book or special or whatever, and they can charge the extra money for it, they're going to. Otherwise, it's effectively leaving money on the table. So you can't. I mean, as much as I'd like to fault them for that, it's kind of hard to. They're in it for a business, and they're making the decisions they've got to make the money.
Yeah, and I should, before I put my words in my mouth, or my foot in my mouth, there we go. It's been a long, long day. I do think that with Marvel, a lot of their number ones that they're coming out with at $4.99 or $5.99 have extra pages in them. I'm not saying that justifies it, but At least it takes a tiny bit of the sting off.
Yeah, it makes it more palatable. It's much different than when they did one of their first $3.99 books, which was X-Men Ghost Stories or something. And I think the story finished like a page or two after the staple.
And I think, Sam, you might have brought it up either last month or previous months, and the comment of, if you really want to get people, give them those extra pages and maybe shave a buck off. Make it so that they can't not pick it up and get into the book, you know, and then let the creative juices prove the point that they need to be reading it, and then get them the $3.99 title ongoing.
Well, and it's not just... And to be fair, I don't read many of those Marvel number ones, but just from John and James's reviews, they seem to get more pages, but rarely do I hear they somehow manage to fit more story.
I think story density is a major problem in comics these days. And it's, I think for a first issue, having a bigger canvas in terms of the number of pages is a good idea, but it also comes down to how well do you use it. And if you figured the plot point at the end of the first issue is going to be X, regardless if you have 20 or 30 pages, the additional 10 pages don't really make that big of a difference.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think part of it is just figuring out how to break down the story to where the first issue actually sets up the full premise and gives the reader enough of a sense of, should I continue with this or not?
Right.
Some writers are great at that, some are not. So you guys got anything else? Or does that pretty much do it?
I think
you want to look at issue numbers. We used to do that. We kind of don't do it much anymore. But
yeah, let's do that real quick because it's skewing a little bit because we've got a lot of the. Well, we had legacy numbers. Now those are going away.
214 of the 300 are 12 or less.
Yeah, that's a little over 70%. And then if you go for the triple digits or higher, or actually just triple digits, yeah, and higher. That's less than 4%, because a lot of what we had with the legacy stuff at Marvel has already kind of flipped back over to new number ones.
Yes, you're basically what? You're on Spawn, Walking Dead, Action, Detective.
Archie books, and I'd have to go look. Not much else.
Yep. Would there be Archie books in the top 300 that would be over that number? I know that they
not
went back
the top
and renumbered to
300, probably below okay. the top 300, because I'm looking at a few yeah. at the bottom there. Those are like the digests and such.
Right, right.
But really, there's only about a quarter of the list is between issue 13 and 99, which is actually not too bad. But it really goes towards, there's a lot of miniseries, a lot of things get retooled in short order, and that's just the way it goes. And I think that's what leads to transient sales when the titles just don't stick around very long.
Looking at things actually in the top 300 that are in the triple digits that haven't been mentioned yet, G.I. Joe, Real American Hero at 256,
yeah,
Terror, yes. Witch of the Black Rose at 112, Spawn, which has already been mentioned. Everything else is legacy number of some sort. You know, Spectacular Spider-Man, Daredevil, Moon Knight, Action, Detective.
And again, many of those are either ending or getting new number ones, and it makes me wonder if in 6 months to a year we're going to go back to legacy, and if it's kind of another pendulum that swings back and forth.
And just below the top 300, another real one is Savage Dragon.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Also Knights of the Dinner Table at 3 9, below the top 300.
And it's funny because I would treat, in my mind, those are two very different things, because Savage Dragon sometimes a little more sporadic when it comes out, but man, Knights of the Dinner Table, month in, month out. They've cut the page count.
They have. It's a magazine to me more than a comic.
I can't speak for how it is now, but when I was reading it for about a year, the amount of comic strip pages they had of like ongoing lengthy story, mm-hmm. essentially comic page type stuff, it was probably more than your average comic.
Well, that I don't disagree. But size, format, paper stock, plus the prose stuff.
It's more magazine than comic. I would agree with that.
It's more akin to a heavy metal.
Exactly.
Or a back issue.
Yeah, close to heavy metal, I'd argue.
I think if you're into the role-playing game stuff, particularly the D&D type stuff, it's something definitely worth checking out. I read it for a bit. I was hoping they would get a little more varied than just the D&D type stuff, and it kind of ran its course for me. But, yeah.
I also wonder where they get sold and how many of those people have diamond accounts versus are they getting it some other
way. They've got to be getting it some other way. We typically, I don't know where we would see them other than in previews. We don't really get much awareness of it until the issues are about 4 to 6 months old, and then they'll show up on the liquidation lists. I can't imagine that they're stocking a ton of them at Diamond. So I'm assuming that they're being sold through some other.
There's got to be some game venue.
I would have expected Alliance would have carried it. I mean, that's Diamond's game distributor.
Yeah.
I don't know. I used to get a lot more role-playing game type stuff when Champions was coming out with a lot of modules and stuff like that, but that's been a couple of years, and there's probably a backlog of things I should get as soon as I've got like another spare bookcase I can find room for in the house. So, anything else? Or does that pretty much do it?
I'm good.
I'll just say this. I certainly enjoy being on these episodes, and I know that they've kind of the last couple months taken a slightly different turn in discussion at times. And I would just like to see if we can get some feedback on if people like these. I know we kind of depart from looking at the individual items on the list a little bit more to talk more about industry trends and things like that. I just like to know if people are enjoying that or if they want to go back to more of the let's slice and dice and go through the numbered list. So I don't know if people want to email you, John, or something.
No, that'd be great. I'd always love feedback. And also, if people have questions, either in general or with the, you know, when the next set of numbers comes out, I put them up on the website. I put them up on CBR.com. If you have questions about those numbers before we record, and there's usually a week or two's worth of time to do that, send those in too.
Absolutely.
Because there are many different directions these discussions can go. Sometimes they're very much on here's how the numbers are for each thing or trends or whatever. And again, we're doing this for the listeners. So if they've got thoughts, I would definitely love to hear that.
Yeah. I know a couple months back, well, maybe almost six, 8 months back, you guys were kind of having a discussion saying, yeah, we feel like we're kind of saying the same things over and over again because the books are doing the same thing. The market's going up and down relative to itself. And you tried to find different discussion areas to talk about, which I think you guys certainly did before I jumped on, and now we've certainly added to that. But yeah, anyone who's got valuable feedback on it, I think that'd be great for us to hear.
Well, and sometimes we talk a little bit more about the new titles, returning titles, and those categories and stuff. Other times we really don't touch on that at all. Do people like that? Would they like more of that, less of that? What? Or is there another slice and dice of the numbers they'd like to see?
Yep.
So,
or if there's anything that from my perspective, I can bring using the Diamond backend. If there's information that people would like, I can certainly try and pull that together too.
That would be cool. So anything else? We good?
Good to go.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com. under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there's at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust and needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, the list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50, 25, or 10 items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which as far as I know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales, any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about the sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside of Diamond Comics distribution channels is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for. And no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer's here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Math, logic, and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.